Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David J. Gibson. He is professor of plant biology and university distinguished scholar at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. And we're talking about his new book, Planting Clues, How Plants Solve Crimes. David, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Great. Thanks for the call.
I don't know what I was expecting. Okay, I thought it was, but this is a serious introduction to forensic botany, and including all sorts of what constitutes evidence and stuff like that. This is a pretty brilliant book, and I recommend it to anybody who sort of religiously watches CSI shows.
And, yes, exactly. Yes.
And like, I just finished binge watching Bones, and you know, these people are just rattling off plants left and right. And yeah, it takes a lot more to it. What finally pushed you to write a book for the general public?
Well, I've written a few books before, and they're textbooks.
Yeah.
And so I teach this course at Southern Illinois University called Forensic Botany. And I thought, well, you know, I've got a textbook we use for that class, but I thought I'd like to write something that was a bit more accessible than the books I've written in the past, which are textbooks. I'd like to write something that you know, anyone that's interested in the subject would be able to access and read, and without getting down in too much detail, you know, bogged down with too much technical stuff. And so that's really where it came from. I thought I'd just have a go at writing this book.
Now, I want to mention for the benefit of the audience, this book is also chock full of cases. And yeah. So, but I don't want to just dwell on the cases. So I want to dwell on some of the basic principles too. To start off, the most critical part of botanic forensic work is the correct identification of specimens. In other words, identifying the plant. And that may sound obvious, but most police departments can't do this.
And that's the problem. That is the problem with this sort of evidence. You've got to get some experts, some botanists, that know how to identify the plants. They have to be involved.
Well, and you make a plea at the end, the code of conquering plant blindness. And the one thing I want to mention about that is not only do professionals need to develop some kind of plant awareness, but I think everyday people basically can't identify 10 plants in their backyard.
That's probably true, yes. Yeah. But there's phone apps now that people can use.
Yeah. I think
the help, you know, the help out.
Now, the book starts with probably one of the most infamous cases in the 20th century, and that was the Lindbergh kidnapping case. Now, for people who don't know that case, and I'm sure most people don't, have never heard of it, can you briefly just describe what happened in it?
Yeah, so that was the case where Charles Lindbergh, who was the fellow that flew across the Atlantic for the first time, so he's a celebrity back in the 30s. One night, his young son was kidnapped from the upper floor of his house. He was downstairs eating dinner or something, and the nurse came running down. The son's gone. And so they called the police and all this sort of thing. And they found out there was a ladder that was down on the ground,
wow.
A homemade ladder. And when they put that up against the wall to the window, it matched exactly. So this was a huge clue. So they brought in a forester.
Arthur Kohler. It's Arthur Kohler.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and they brought him in, and to look at it, and he, you know, identified what the wood was, pine and things like that, and he also looked at the saw marks on the rails.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Yeah, and he was able to match after a lot of work, and he went on all sorts of sawmills and found out where the wood had come from. In the meantime, they were getting ransom notes from the abductor.
Yeah, they got, what, 13 ransom notes?
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, and so they passed over some funds, some money, and they eventually caught this suspect through the money that he tried to pass off. So then they found that this suspect was someone that worked in the sawmill where the wood came from.
Mm-hmm.
It also cut out boards from his attic in his home that were there.
Now, the amazing thing about this, David, is was this one of the first times a specialist in plant material, in this case a forester, or a person who knew about Wood was testified in a case.
Yes, it was.
And it led to the suspect's execution, Richard Hauptmann.
Yeah, I mean, he was found guilty. I mean, the evidence, the Wood evidence, is absolutely right there, and it tied him to the ladder, to the crime scene, and all of that. So there's really no question about they had the right person.
Now, you also in that same chapter, you talk about a later case in 1985, and a Wood anatomist called Regis Miller IDing the correct tree. Is that what's happening in plant forensics now? Is that people specialize so that there's a tree plant forensic? You talk about people who were specialized in bryophytes and all sorts of other things. But it seems like, is it specialty work now?
Well, I think that what happens is if a crime scene investigator finds or notices some plant material at a crime scene or related to a crime, they will then look for someone that can identify it. So they'll probably go to the local university or something like that and try and find an expert. From my understanding, crime labs don't have botanists on staff.
Yeah.
So they'll have to go and look for someone. And so I talk about in the book one of my colleagues, Barbara Crandall-Stott.
Oh, yeah, okay.
A moss expert. And she was brought in because local around where I'm living in southern Illinois, they found some plant fragments that look like moss of some sort, and she is a moss expert. So they brought her in and said, "What's this stuff? What's this moss?" And she's able to identify it. And
but wait, I want to stop there. Didn't that take a process? Like, she collected the specimens and then actually grew them?
No.
Well, there was another case where somebody actually had to grow the moss specimens. I think it was moss specimens in order to identify. In other words, this thing takes time. You can't just rattle it off the top of your head.
Yeah, some cases that can be like that. I mean, they found mosses growing over skulls.
Yeah,
you can get an idea of how long it takes the moss to grow. There was another case where called the wilted sunflowers, where they found that decomposing sunflowers were associated with the crime scene, and so the person did there, the botanist Jane Bock, was to take some sunflowers and literally just watch them decompose and see how long it took for them to decompose to match how they were at the crime scene. So then she could say, well, it must have been this amount of time that the body was there covered with these dead sunflowers. So sometimes, yeah, there's got to be some experiments that are done to kind of look at the time course of development, growth, decomposition of plant materials.
So what we're talking about, and I just want to use some terminology that you use in the book, is the PMI, the post-mortem interval. And in this case, you can tell when the body was laid down. And that's critically important to solving a murder case. Now, it seems to me one of the most first and foremost is to have police people don't just sort of barge in when they find a body in the woods, but to be careful about the moving material, disturbing the site, and try to call somebody in early on to see if there's any plant clues there are on the body or around the body.
Yeah, and that would be true for plant evidence and any sort of evidence. I mean, they have to be really careful in accessing a crime scene, walking in on the same path every time, keeping people out that aren't supposed to be there and that sort of thing.
How often does that really happen?
What, you mean?
People being super careful about the body site.
I don't know. I assume it happens every time. I would hope so.
Well, dream on.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, there's some great people that are introduced in the history of plant forensics that you introduce in this book. And I want to talk about Locard and Locard's exchange principle. What is that?
That's the idea that every time somebody goes to a crime scene, they pick up materials from the crime scene, like dust or pollen or seeds or plant fragments, and they carry it away with them. And so if you can find a suspect and look and see if they've got the same shoes on, and you look at the mud in the bottom of their shoes, it's probably going to have plant material, seeds, and so forth that they collected from the crime scene. Because every time we touch something, we're going to retain some of that material from that location.
And we're talking about very small things. We're talking about things like pollen grains, very tiny amounts of plant material that are crucial to identifying the site.
Yeah, things that you can't see. And so the criminal would have no idea. I mean, they just walk through the crime scene, and as they're walking through, conducting the crime, they're going to be collecting material on their clothes, even pollen in their eyebrows, up their nose, collecting all sorts of stuff. And it wouldn't be just plant material as well, but any sort of dust. You're going to get onto them, onto their clothes, onto their body, and they're going to take it away with them.
Can we just talk about Edmond Lacard for a bit, the so-called Sherlock Holmes of France? What an amazing person he was. I never heard of him before I read your book.
Yeah, so yeah, he set up this lab in the 30s in France, in Lyon, in France, a forensics lab, and he wrote an enormous amount of material. I mean, loads of books that he's written, all in French, of course, about his forensic activities and this exchange principle that he established. And part of the forensic evidence that he got into was what he called les organic poissures, which is organic dust. And that includes plant materials. There's a one, and he talks about several cases. One which I really like is a body was found, and they didn't know who had killed this person, but they got some suspects, and he noticed that on one of the suspects there was a seed of a plant on the lapel of the jacket of the suspect. And he went back to the crime scene, and of course the local gendarmes had completely ruined the crime scene. They trampled all over it. But right next to where the body was found, there was a plant, a somewhat rare plant, that was the same plant of the seed that was found on the jacket of the suspect.
Oh, man.
And that tied that suspect to the crime scene, a single seed.
Wow. He wrote a seven-volume treatise on criminology. But he was still not even the first to recognize the value of plants in forensic investigations. There were people earlier?
No, I think he was, well, maybe, but not to the extent that he brought it out and put it together. So, in his books, I think some of the cases that he talks about were not his cases, but cases that he knew about.
Now, what's the Fry challenge?
The Fry challenge, this is to do with bringing evidence into court. This is the idea that the evidence that an expert witness will talk about in court has to be scientifically approved. And
how is that determined? Is it up to the judge to determine that?
Yeah, I think it really is. The opposing counsel can offer up a challenge and say, this evidence is not good scientific evidence. And so that would be called a Fry challenge or a Daubert challenge. There's a couple of different versions of this. And then really the judge has to look at it and say, well, and listen to the two counsels and make a ruling on whether to accept into court the evidence. Of course, there's a lot of precedents of this. And so the first time some new evidence is brought in, like the first time that plant DNA was brought in, that would have been challenged. But once it's been brought into court, then, of course, the counsels will say, well, plant DNA evidence has been brought in before. Why would you not bring it in this time?
But are judges, learned enough in science to determine what's good evidence?
Probably not. that's the job of the counsel, to bring in witnesses that can be credible.
Well, that's the challenge of the plant forensic specialist too, that they need to present evidence that is pretty clear cut.
Yeah.
That's unchallengeable. Because there must be cases where people brought in conflicting evidence.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I talk about one in the book where there was a drive-by shooting between someone shot at someone in a car, and then the police stopped him, and the suspect ran off, and he threw the gun and a hoodie into some bushes. And they collected the hoodie and everything, and when they brought it to court, they didn't bring in any botanists, but the police officer said, yeah, it's the same leaves on the hoodie that are in the bush. And that was a case where really they did not bring in botanical experts, but the evidence was accepted without really looking at it properly, I would say.
Huh. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David J. Gibson, professor of plant biology and university distinguished scholar at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale. And we're talking about his new book, Planting Clues, How Plants Solve Crimes. I think the thing I never thought of until I came across it in your book is not only talking about stuff that's transported on your body or around the body, but plant food in your stomach.
Yes, yes.
Now, this was amazing, working out a victim's last meal. And there was a very specific case in your book where they had to reconstruct a timeline based on what the food was in the person's stomach, which is a lot of plant food. For me, the amazing thing is somebody developed a reference database of samples of plants fragmented as they appeared in gastric, contents. Talk about that. I mean, what a project.
Yes. So, yeah, that case was by someone called Jane Bock, who's a professor at University of Colorado in Boulder. And she was asked to look at gastric contents to determine, as you said, you know, what the victim had eaten, because they wanted to know the timeline. And they knew that this victim had lunch with her boyfriend at lunchtime. But then when Professor Bott looked at the gastric contents, they didn't match what they knew the person had had at lunch, but different materials.
Huh.
But to do that, what she had to do was literally take the plant fragments she was given and look at them under a microscope and look at the cellular structure. But she needed to match it up with plant materials that the suspect might have eaten, so like beans and things like that, and lettuce and so forth. So in order to do that, she literally took what she thought might be the plant materials and chewed them up.
Wow.
And then spat them out and then put them onto the microscope.
Wow.
And so that was the first case. But after that, you know, she got a reputation for doing this. And so she did this for about 70 different plants, or had people do it for her, and took pictures of the plant materials as they would be after being chewed up and in the stomach.
And you have some examples in the book.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so it's a fascinating approach, but again, terribly important, because to identify the last meal that someone had, it can really put a timeline on the events leading up to their death.
And eventually,
the stomach will hold the materials for a couple of hours. So if you got stomach materials, you know it's what they ate up to 2 hours ago.
And I think she eventually also included material in vomit and feces, and to see what that is like, as again evidence that it could be, again, give a timeline, a PMI, of the time of death. The amazing thing is that there are a lot of databases that are formed through these long processes like that. Like, there's a thing people probably never heard of that is mentioned in your book, body farms. Tell me what they do and what they are.
I'm sorry, what was that? Body
farms? Body farms.
Oh, body farms, yes. So if you find a body out in the woods, you want to know the PMI. You want to know how long it's been there. And a body will decompose. It'll break down. The soft tissues will break down and the bones will disarticulate and so forth. So there are around the country, around the United States and some internationally, sites where investigators are literally putting bodies out either on the ground or burying them and then looking to see how long it takes, looking at the stages of breakdown of these bodies. And of course, you can only do very limited investigations with human subjects, of course. So a lot of this work has been done with things like pigs and so forth. But the body farms use bodies that have been donated to science, and they literally put them out and watch them decompose.
And as you bring up in the book, bodies decompose at different rates, whether they're buried or just dumped. And also the kind of habitat, whether it's like a humid area, whether it's time of the year, whether it's winter or summer, all of that changes. And then the kinds of plants that and fungi and stuff like that that grow up around the body is different for every case.
Yes, and that's what makes it so complicated and fascinating, because everywhere you go, there's going to be a different set of plants locally that would grow on the soil above a body, above a clandestine grave, and so forth. And there hasn't been too much research done into this. This is something where there's a real need to know more. But they are finding that, above a body, if a body is buried, the sorts of plants that will grow on that grave will be a little bit different to those that are in the surrounding area, because the soil has been turned over and a lot of annual plants will grow and so forth. So that can help find a clandestine grave. Sometimes fungi will grow on the skin, and that will help knowing what the fungi are, how long the body has been there. Again, helping with learning about the PMI. And so there's a lot of things that can be learned from looking at these body farms.
There's a case that I found it fascinating, where plants helped to determine whether a death was an accident or a suicide or a murder. And in the case, they found out that the woman had fallen and hit planters on her way down, and she wasn't murdered.
Oh, that was the case where a man fell off a cliff.
Okay, that was
talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So in that case, I think it's in Italy. A man was found at the bottom of a bluff. And was he pushed off?
Yeah.
Or did he fall down or whatever? And they found plant fragments on his clothes that were from plants that were kind of halfway down the cliff. The other one, yes, I remember the other one you talked about was a suicide where a woman fell off a building.
Right. That's the one I was talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, I got it now. Yeah. So that was the case where they weren't sure if it was hit and run or not, where the woman had been knocked over by a car. But they found plant fragments in her hair that matched up with plants that were growing in a sort of flower box halfway down the side of the building. So they determined that she must have fallen from the top of the building. And she had some history of mental problems as well. So they determined in this case it was a suicide.
There's a case that David Hall worked on where the body, it was the whole site was completely trampled on and messed up and the body removed. And most of the evidence was just disturbed, but he found one, I think, single tibia.
Yes.
And from that, he could determine stuff because of plants. Hello?
Hello? Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay. But, I mean, he had a single tibia, and underneath the tibia, there was a plant growing, I think, and he was able to determine things from that single tibia.
Yes. So this is another case where they want to know how long the body's been there, or in this case, the bone has been there. And underneath that tibia, that bone, there was a leaf of a plant. And they determined from the amount of degradation of that leaf how long it must have been there.
Wow.
Because once you put the bone or something on top of a plant, then it's going to, it's changed from if it's just sitting out in the open. And so this, again, helped with the timing. But he had to do some work. He had to, look into how long it takes for plant leaves to decompose when they change color from a nice green color to a brown color and so forth. So we had to bring in some knowledge and expertise about leaf decomposition.
Wow.
A single bone on top of a single leaf. Amazing.
Now, at your own institution, there's the Complex for Forensic Anthropology Research Facility.
Yes.
Talk to me about what that does.
That's one of these body farms.
That's amazing. Now, yeah, do you use both human bodies and animal bodies?
The faculty member that runs that, called Gretchen Dabbs, has human bodies. And she's got some of them that are on the surface of the ground and some of them that were buried.
And people can donate their bodies to this?
Yes, they can.
Wow.
Yes.
As soon as I read that, I started thinking maybe that's what I should do with my body.
Well,
don't hold me to it right yet, but I was thinking about that.
I'll let her know.
Okay, yeah, tell her to get in contact. We only have minutes left, and I just... You actually move into the water, too, and you have a fascinating chapter about diatoms, which we can't even get into. Diatoms are beautiful, and you have some stunning photographs. But they're essentially single-cell plants from the water. One of the things you can tell is whether the person was killed on land and then the body dumped in the water, or whether they were killed in the water because the way diatoms are absorbed in the body.
Yes, that's just fascinating. That when a body is drowning, there's last gasps trying to breathe, and of course they're breathing in water, are so powerful that diatoms, which are tiny, as you said, single cells, will pass through the lungs, through the alveoli, into the bloodstream. And at that point, the blood is still flowing, and they'll move into the major organs and to the bone marrow. And so if you get a body and there are diatoms in the bone marrow or in the liver, that must have been from a drowning. If a body's already dead, then there's not that power to bring things into the blood, and the blood's not moving. And so there'll be diatoms in the lungs, in the water in the lungs, but there won't be in the organs or the bone marrow.
And one of the other things is that it's not just the plants right around the body, but you talk about how the entire ecology of the area is important for the forensic botanist.
Yes, and as far as diatoms are concerned, the different sorts of diatom species, the makeup of them, mm-hmm. will match if the body was drowned or dumped in that location. If the body had been from somewhere else, then there may be a different suite of diatom species.
We're completely out of time. We could talk about this book for years.
Yeah, we could.
There's a lot in his, and I want to mention, we skipped over most of the cases. There's all these great cases in this book, too. My guest tonight is David J. Gibson. He's a professor of plant biology and university distinguished scholar at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. And we're talking about his new book. It's really good. And it's good science, too. Planting Clues, How Plants Solve Crimes. David, it's a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.